which they met it with such eagerness to, and they became literate. School that I want to talk about, however, is, I wanted to say too, the king and the queen used to pick children of high potential, and they would send them away for an education. They deliberately sent them to Italy, to France, to England, because they wanted to groom leaders, and they wanted them to be world citizens. They wanted them to know what they wanted them to be of the world and yet know their own culture well. The queen herself spoke 3 foreign languages. She composed music. She translated the ancient chants. She was steeped in the hula and the oli. So she and the king, and he was the first king to whatever it means for a small and feeble nation, to go around the world, made a trip around the world to see how the rest of the world lived, and he had a very global kind of understanding and wanted his subjects to have that kind of understanding also, besides, and it was the king who, despite the missionaries' objections, restored the hula, the chants, and all the ancient learning too. He did it in, despite the great missionary objections to pagan learning and to anti-Christian or whatever they called it at that time. At the Kamehameha schools, there are 3 divisions that comprise the educational program. There is a campus program for about 2,000 students, with about a third of that student body who are boarders. They live on campus. And that division has strengthened its program to where they expect from the sophomore years, the students are to take the scholastic aptitude tests. They are given all the cultural courses and the cultural languages and the orientations, as well as they are given computer instruction. They are given the best that you might define it as Western education, but they're also not, they're given that opportunity to learn that too, so that when they come out of that school, when they graduate, we are now, as a result of the last 10 years of work, they're going into the finest colleges in the nation, and they expected to come back and be leaders in the community. The President's Advisory Council is not just Hawaiian people either. We have on our advisory board the chief executive officers of the largest industries and corporations in the business world in Hawaii. And the reason why we think that's important, as well as the people in the Department of Education, is because we know we have to sensitize the state of Hawaii and the other kinds of people. We know that we want them to be sensitive and to understand and appreciate the first culture of the islands. And that is the reason why we have that kind of makeup. The second division, the second program in this school, is the Extension Education Division. And that division is composed, first of all, let me go back to the campus program objectives, the objectives of the whole school, so that you know that you have an idea of what they look to. By the year 2000, the achievement scores of Hawaiian students will be at least at parity with national norms as measured by national standardized tests in reading and mathematics. A high percentage of students in the campus program will demonstrate achievement of exit skills at levels appropriate to their potential. On an ongoing basis, high-risk pre-kindergarten children in our programs will demonstrate readiness for kindergarten at an appropriate age level as measured by appropriate tests. By December 1985, we will have assisted the State Department of Education in developing up to 4 models of alternative education programs with an 80% success ratio measured by graduates returning and remaining in the mainstream for at least 10 months of completion. Methods and results will be shared by other agencies. Another goal is to develop culturally related academic materials and conduct programs for public and private schools, which will reduce the negative impact of loss of culture and cultural difference. By September 1st, 1997, the percent of Hawaiians enrolled in and succeeding in all post-secondary education institutions will correspond to the proportion of Hawaiians in the statewide population. We will also be concerned with the types of post-secondary education. In extension education, But goes on, as to assist the State Department of Education in developing and maintaining, again, four models of alternative education and up to three continuing education models, sharing methods and results with other agencies. To develop culture-related education materials and conduct programs which will reduce barriers to educational achievement, which may be related to loss of culture and cultural difference. And to increase, again, the percentage of Hawaiians enrolling succeeding post-educational institutions. The education Extension Education Division is comprised of seven major components: neighbor island resources on three islands, a Hawaiian Studies Institute, summer programs, alternative education, Na'apu'apawahi, which is a remedial program, continuing education, and Na'ahu'okama'apawahi, which is a scholarship fund for children graduating from, not from Kamehameha, from the other public schools who wish to continue their education. In addition, the new activities for this year is an interesting one. We talk about land. We have a co-op reforestation project where the students will be involved in the planting of 10,000 koa seedlings in Hilo. We have an intense teacher training program for alternative education staff with a focus on cooperative learning and evaluation. There is an adult basic skills interagency model that we have incorporated. We also serve adults. I could go on, but I think I'll go on to the third division, which is the Center for the Development of Early Education. And that center, they're charged with the responsibility of educating preschool and elementary school children and the development, dissemination, demonstration of methods for improving the education for Hawaiian children from prenatal to 12 years old. So there, we have a study with 40 families right now. Expectant mothers, and looking at the ways Native families prepare themselves for an education, the education experience. We have a pre-kindergarten demonstration school. We work with all state agencies and the University of Hawaii because we think that that has the 20% of the school population is made up of Native Hawaiian children, and we do the public schools have a mandate to continue Hawaiian studies in the public schools, and we feel that we have to assist and strengthen and reinforce those programs so that it not only impacts on Native children, it impacts on all of the children who go to the public schools, and all of them benefit from it. We also assist the elderly. For instance, we have a kupuna program. The grandmothers and grandfathers go into our public schools and they conduct Hawaiian language lessons, lessons in Hawaiian dance and song, and the effective learning that is also a spinoff as a result of these experiences brings a closeness, a unity that is important if we want Native Hawaiian education to a Native Hawaiian culture to survive and last in our islands. Those are the three. I will tell you that the campus program, 2,000 kids, the alternative extension education programs, 33,000 children, 2,000 adults, the Center for Research and Development, about 2,000 DOE students and the 40 families they talked about, and it's costly. The campus program budget for the next biennium is $9,219,000. The Extension Education Program is $3,516,000. The Center for Research and Development is $5,800,000. It's an expensive venture. It's all privately financed by the legacy of the princess.
Thank you, Guard. Moana, did you wish to add something?
I would like to. I've just taken a few notes as we... as we've gone along, seeing the children here, you know, it's, you know, I hope we do keep in mind, and you know, that reminds us, one of the reasons that we're here is because we're concerned about our children and we're concerned about their futures, not only those here today, but those coming tomorrow. This whole issue of blood quantum that was raised earlier. We have a situation right now where it's 50% Hawaiians are able to get, are considered native Hawaiians and are able to get benefits from our trusts, whether it be Hawaiian homestead lands, Hawaiian reservation lands, or assets of our ceded lands. You know, what the feeling is that with we Hawaiians, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, as has been said, has taken a position on lowering this blood quantum. And I wasn't a member of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs at the time that they took this vote. There is concern in the Hawaiian community about the fact that lowering this blood quantum. And I think that even Native Hawaiians that are attempting to sue the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, have pointed out a concern that at least the decision be made by 50% and 100% Hawaiians, that the decision to lower the blood quantum would be voted upon by those that are most affected. Also, it should be understood that the more Hawaiian you've had, the more Hawaiian you have, the more economic and social problems you have as well. That's where so many of our problems lie. Some of the comments you made, Mr. Goldwyn, about the fact that we're all brothers and sisters, and if that were the case, and we're all created equal, if that were the case, there wouldn't be the need for native concern. If in the past and in the present we have been treated as brothers and sisters by the dominant culture, and we are in this quandary. And as you mentioned, there's also, as with any good relationship or marriage, there's the need for love. Well, if this love has been shown to we Native peoples as by those that came into our lands, instead of treating us like we're pariah, and considering us subhuman in some instances, if that love were there, we wouldn't probably be in this round table today. Oren mentioned this alienability of land, and that's a big, big danger. As examples of what's happened in Hawaii to Hawaiian trusts that were set up to help the Hawaiian people, this Queen's Hospital that Gard had mentioned earlier. Queen Hospital, there is a hospital, but before, as Hawaiians, you could go there and be treated and not have to pay anything. There are native hospitals here. We don't have that luxury. So in the past, these hospitals, natives would be treated for free. Several of our queens started hospitals, Queen Kapiolani Maternal Hospital, as well as Queen's Hospital, which was started under Queen Emma. You know, these hospitals at one time had large land bases, not just those hospitals. Also, Gard had mentioned Lunalilo Home, a home for our elders. Now, this also had large land base, but through the years, the institutions remain, but their land bases have been alienated. The land bases have disappeared. So now we don't have those land bases, and we also have to pay to go into these hospitals that were set up to give us free medical service. So also the Gard was mentioning the Bishop Estate and the Kamehameha Schools. Bernice Puahi Bishop was the daughter of my great-great-great-grandfather, but although I have no resources, but that's beside the point. The Kamehameha Schools, as Gard had mentioned, in the early days of Kamehameha School, they sent the young people ended up going to Europe to school. And different institutions in Europe, and they came back, from what I have been told by elders of ours, they came back with such high ideas, they came back, they'd learned very, very well. Well, this was a threat. The Kamehameha Schools, it was our princess that had set it up, but it was three of the five original trustees helped to overthrow the monarchy. So when these young people came back near the turn of the century with all of these fine ideas that they had picked up in Europe, the Kamehameha School started changing. It changed to make us farmers. It changed to other knowledge they were supposed trying to. They stifled our intellectual avenues, because they saw that the early students had come back with good tools, and this was a threat to those who had stolen our nation. So this whole emphasis was changed from going to these fine schools. We were relegated. Today, a number of the Kamehameha schools, although we do have some doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs, to excuse the expression, that come out of that school, many end up being police, working for the police department, the fire department, climbing the telephone poles, and the electric company. So it's in a lot of instances, and the firemen, a lot of instances, many have been relegated to the role of keeping the instead of being the leaders, we end up climbing the telephone poles and being the policemen. Now, this is after taking some of the top so-called considered brain power of the Hawaiian community. The tests are very, very hard to get into that school. When I went to school there, I think it was 1,500 of us took the test, and only several hundred were lucky enough, and it's supposed to be such a great honor going to that school, pass. So they take the top brain power, and then they relegated them in a lot of instances to considered subservient positions in the community, considering the vast resources of this school. So, and also as far as the culture was concerned, it wasn't until we started the Hawaiian movement in 1970 and started saying to these leaders of Kamehameha School, and I went to Kamehameha School, what you do is you program us to be good whitewashed brownies, because there was never very much culture taught at the school until after the consciousness, the renaissance, until after the Native Peoples Movement started in Hawaii. And I think that it's important to point that out. Rosita had mentioned, I'm glad she did, that, you know, about the whole issue of land, because that's a very, very top priority for Native peoples. You need land to live on. You need land for your families. You need land to grow food on, especially in a place where it costs a great deal of money to live. I wanted to get back to what I believe his name is Paul, the educator, had said. The fact that once you get an education, you change and you're not the same. I think it's, an education can be very good to use as a tool to be able to help our people. For some of us, we've learned through getting a higher education that we've learned how the game of the dominant culture through that education. You know, it's important to learn skills to be able to help your people. But unfortunately, some that have become more higher educated have lost touch with the values of our people, our culture, and our land. And that's where the problem comes in. It's not too much education, but it's losing the values that are very, very important to your peoples. And that's where the problem comes in. This whole situation of corporate natives versus traditional natives. In some instances, maybe the corporate natives, they lose touch again with their values, and money becomes the god. In God we trust on the dollar bill, and it ends up being the people and the land be damned, and let's sell it, and why not? But then when you have, what are we going to tell the generations coming forward after the land is gone? Again, you know, the threat of the corporations, we have to remember that they think in terms of dollars and not in terms of people, land, and native rights. So that's something that we really must keep in mind, and we can't lose sight of. Mahalo.
Thank you, Moana. Dissa, you wanted to say a few words?
Mr. Berger, my name is pronounced Disa.
Sorry.
Don't be sorry. No one ever gets it right the first time. My name is Disa Jacobson. I was born in Hooper Bay. My father is Yupik and my mother is Athabascan. What I'm hearing from this roundtable discussion are three things that press buttons in me, if you will, and one is education. I don't know what that education is going to consist of, but I hope to God you guys don't do the same thing that happened to me. I already knew how to skin animals and bake bread and chop wood, and I was 9 years old. and I came to Anchorage, and they were going to educate me, and they said, okay, you're going to take this class. Fine. What is it? It's home ec. Okay, we'll go to home ec. What are you going to learn me to do today, teacher? Make Jell-O. It doesn't make sense. That's like taking a Native kid out of the village to send to a university to study to be a Native. Any man, Yupik man, who constructs a kayak is an engineer. Our shamans, and I don't even like the word shamans because of all the goodies that were laid on that, were doctors. They understood science and they understood physics. Why would we want to take someone out of that environment to teach them something else unless it's to change them? Now, I'm up here for a number of reasons, and one is I not only want to be a part of history, but I want to make darn sure that I'm an ancestor, too. I understand, well, being present at the tail end of a symposium the other night, one of the keynote speakers said we just don't go around killing Indians anymore, and I thought, oh my, there are four ways that you can kill a human being. I don't recollect the gentleman's name, but he named them all. One is emotional, physical, sexual destruction of property and pets. I can talk about this because I specialize in the dynamics and politics of violence, but well-meaning people, in the name of God, were going to educate us. And their education process is now classified as a felony. It was an act of violence to spiritually rape us. What we're saying now is, yes, we accept it. It did happen. No, we don't like it. And I think the first word that should be put into that educational system from grades K through 12 is no. We could teach other people the same thing that we're teaching children in the villages. How they respond to sexual assault is no. You have no right to do that to me. No one has the right to do that to me. If I let you mess with my body, my emotions, my intellect, you're going to take my land, because the end product of any act of violence is death of someone. Whoever that's inflicted on will die. We're finding that a lot of people, and I hear them being called New Wave Natives, and what was the other term about Afghani, I don't know what that means, but I have a sneaky hunch that if we don't study the history of what we've been through, someone tells me that we're doomed to repeat it. An orphanage was constructed in a village. The inside of it was renovated by the fathers and brothers and uncles and grandfathers of these orphan children. The education in there would have been Christian. The name of this orphanage is named after an Alaskan missionary who wrote several wonderful documents using the term white male superiority for these diseased, heathen, ignorant people. But I was filled with love as I was riding over those niggerheads to that school. Now, they're naming it after this kind of a man. This did not happen in the 1800s. This is happening now. Who gave anyone the right to take the children away from their living parents? Nobody did. From what I understand from the symposium that was done the other night, this type of treatment went on for the sake of getting the treasures that were owned by the indigenous people of that area. Rosita made a comment that perhaps we need a lobbyist, perhaps we need this. Anyway, we have to pay someone to do that. We don't know where we're going to get the money. We got money. We have so much money in the natural resources of the land that it cannot be calculated. So if you want oil, we got oil. You want diamonds, I got diamonds. You want timber, I got timber. If you want it, you can have some of it, but you don't need to kill me to get it. Because the movement with Native women in the state of Alaska started with one word, no. No, you can't. No, you don't have the right. Yes, I have the right not to like it. I was interested in Mr. Goldwyn's reaction yesterday, which was okay, which I appreciated, when apparently a speaker said, as a woman, I'm going to scold you. I don't think a scolding is necessary if what we call the dominant culture will really look at what's happened to us and really look at the history of well-meaning educators, of well-meaning tradesmen, of well-meaning conquerors, if you will. Look at the history to make sure that that doesn't happen again and to put a stop to those forces that are already penetrating the indigenous people of the Arctic. I am told we have 21 years left, and alcohol will take us at the rate that we're going. If one of the four categories of violence is the destruction of property or pets, what we tell women that are battered is when that happens, the message from the perpetrator is loud and clear. This is what I'm going to do to you. What is our property and our pets but the tundra and the reindeer and caribou that are on it? If someone is going to go in there and mine my land without even asking me permission if they can do that, that's the destruction of my property. That's the destruction of my pets, salmon. And nobody has the right to do that. We're saying no to ANSCA, and we're saying no to spiritual battering. We're saying no to everyone and anyone that would cause a disruption in Yupik society and with the four quadrants that make us human, just like you do. Thank you for this opportunity, and I appreciate this.
Mr. Goldwyn, you wanted 15 seconds.
Well, that was if Shelton would cooperate with me. I gave him a brief list of objectives for Native education. I'm not sure whether he wants to present it.
Well,
he agreed with it, and we were going to do it jointly.
All right.
But I can do it in 2 minutes if...
All right, we've only got 2 minutes, and then we have to clear out.
I prepared this list because, talking to Verna Kirkness yesterday, because I thought... If one started out with an incomplete and tentative list of what the criteria would be for judging education for Native Alaskans, that a lot would come out in the discussion of it, seeing where you wanted to go and how you wanted to do it, and so I present this very briefly. First, fluency in the Native language as a criterion, an objective. Second, development preparation for full membership in the tribe or the Native community. And that would include necessary subsistence skills, knowledge of the history, arts, culture, and I put down religion, then I crossed it out because you get into all kinds of problems of trying to teach religion in schools, but it would come about anyhow, I think, if the idea were full preparation for membership in the community or tribe. And third, leadership in the community, political, cultural, educational, especially, that is development of your own teachers, and the health services and everything else you can think of. But so not only membership, but leadership. Now then, the list extends, and here I think come the tests of just where you think the place of the Native community will be in relationship to the non-Native community. Fluency in English, preparation for citizenship in the United States and in the state of Alaska, including these preparations for leadership there too. And finally, the one that I think would require the most discussion would be choice. Preparation for a truly free choice of how far to go in education and the kind of adult life to live and where it would be lived and in what sort of pursuits and in what relationship to the Native community. But then I add, with a strong preference for a life devoted to the Native community. I present those as suggestive of what use you could put criteria to, because starting with that list, you can decide, first of all, how incomplete it is and what else would have to be added. How far to go in it would raise the problems of the relationship of the community to the non-Native community, and it leaves the arduous task of trying to decide how to implement those objectives.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Goldwin. I want to thank you all. We've had a good 4 days discussing the place of Native people in the Western world or the world itself. Might I make one suggestion that would appropriately sum up the discussion? I know there's a thousand loose ends. No one expected that we would tie them all up. A philosopher named Pascal once said that the object in life should be to become what you are. And perhaps the discussion about education is really directed toward enabling Native people to become what they are. And you have to know what you are to engage in a process of becoming what you are. Well, my thanks to all the members of the round table and best wishes for a good trip home. Thanks especially to our friends from Canada and from Hawaii and from the Lower 48. And my thanks as well, I feel I should say this, to the 1,450 and more Alaska Native people who spoke to this commission at all of those villages far from the centers of power. And I want to promise them through you that my report will reflect what they have told us. I think I should say that my recommendations will be designed to be helpful to Alaska Natives and to Native people in other countries. It will be submitted to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference in September, and I, with some pleasure, come to the end of the public hearings of the Alaska Native Review Commission. The only other thing I have to say is that you are obliged to leave the hall at once so that they can set up the bingo tables. Thank you again.